Spirit Radio Podcasts.
The new Catholic primary school sex education programme has been published this week. So what do parents and teachers need to know in terms of the content, and why has it been revised? These are some of the questions we're going to talk to next with Kate Liffey. She's a teacher, mum and former National Director of Catechetics. Kate, we might start with that question. Just why was it revised in the first place?
Well, thanks, Wendy, and good morning to you and to your listeners. I think the question is an important one in terms of the context. So your listeners may be aware that a number of years ago, the then Minister for Education and Skills, Richard Bruton, called for a review of the SPHE and RSE, basically. And that review was undertaken by the NCCA. So it was a review into relationships and sexuality education. And as part of that process, I, in my role as National Director for Catechetics, working with CPSMA and the other entities within the Bishops' Conference, went on a bit of a road trip, and we went around and we met teachers and we met students, we met parents, we met chairs of boards of management. And we really, really listened to their concerns and to their inputs and their ideas around RSE in Catholic schools. And one of the things that came out really strongly, and by the way, it came out strongly in the NCCA's own review as well, was the need for updated resources and materials. So that's where this programme has come out of, really, a grassroots call for more supports in this area. And I know as a teacher myself, you're always looking for new and fresh and kind of bright material and up-to-date material. So that's where it came out of, Wendy.
And obviously, as you said, Kate, you did a lot of consultation, and I know you were involved with a bit of the writing and a lot of the liaising. So what were the key factors that you had to consider, and what are the core themes contained within this programme?
Well, I think the place to start is probably to say that at primary level, you know, obviously we have an integrated curriculum, and a lot of people ask questions around an integrated curriculum and why is there an integrated curriculum, and they might identify difficulties with that, particularly as it relates to ethos. But an integrated curriculum at primary level is there because it integrates, that's how children's brains work. They integrate things. So, you know, I have children in primary school, and when they come home with their English reading, it's related to something to do with geography or history. So an integrated curriculum is at the heart of primary education in developed countries all across the world. That's how education at primary is done. So that's a really important point to note in terms of RSE. And that's how children's brains work, by integrating their learning. So that's the first thing. The second thing is to say, really, something around values. And the NCCA is really clear, as is the Education Act, you know, that values education is a really, really important part of how we do our work in schools, not just Catholic schools, but all schools. But then, I suppose, you have to ask the question, well, whose values? And that's really up to individual patrons with their boards of management, with their parents.
I suppose, Kate, that would be kind of one of the concerns that some parents might have, and maybe you've already had this feedback, is that in many parts of the country there is a situation where you might have families who aren't Catholic but their children are going to Catholic primary schools, and they would say, you know, I'm not comfortable with my child being taught a worldview on sexuality and sex education that's through the Catholic or Christian lens, and I'd rather it be based on kind of secular values or based on science. What do you say to that?
Absolutely. You know, I totally hear that. And every school is required in consultation with parents at local level to develop its own RSE policy. And this programme is really in support of schools that want additional material. And that's the place, as I said earlier, that from which it comes. I suppose the broader question is probably underpinning that question or query parents would have is, what values are my children going to be taught in this school that I'm sending them to? And the values underpinning RSE and the values underpinning everything that happens in a Catholic school are very accessible for everyone. They're rooted in care of the child, an understanding of the child's needs, educational, social, spiritual, all of those needs, an understanding of the child in terms of holistic learning. They're rooted in values like inclusion. They're rooted in values like compassion and solidarity, care of our common home, social justice. So those values have a lot in common with a human rights approach because, you know, obviously, in many respects, Jesus Christ was somebody who was very interested in human rights, and that was what motivated and has motivated Christian engagement in education.
Yeah, so I think a lot of parents might say, okay, they're good values for my child to have, but is there an option for parents who still say, no, I'd prefer to look after kind of sex education in my own home, to opt out of this programme?
In terms of that PCS, of course, I mean, the NCCA, the Department of Education, is very clear that in line with parents' constitutional rights, any element of provision in a primary school and up to the age of 18, a post-primary, the child can be opted out of that provision. So that's key. I mean, that's obviously central. But I think what's important too to say in terms of parental concerns is that RSE in a Catholic school is very invitational. That's the pedagogy underpinning the approach suggested by the NCCA. And by the way, this programme Flourish is written entirely in line with the NCCA curriculum. So it's invitational. So, for example, in terms of, obviously the headline issue over the last few days has been around same-sex marriage.
Yeah, one of the lines that was in a lot of the papers was puberty is a gift from God.
Yeah, and I mean, I actually kind of found that one interesting that was picked out, because for Christians, for people of faith, everything is a gift from God. And what we're trying to say through this program, in a very invitational way, is that, this is a viewpoint, it's a perspective. It's not a viewpoint we're kind of insisting everyone share with us. But it would be very dishonest of the church not to say these things. It wouldn't be true to the church's values and the church's ethos if we were to kind of gloss over this vision. It's a vision of the human person that's very rich. And, you know, as a parent of young children, I know that it's my responsibility to do this kind of learning and teaching with them at home. And I do that. So I think a lot of parents understand that, and that's clear in terms of the department's own documentation, that the prime responsibility for RSE lies in the home, and that anything done in any school type supplements that. And so this program is very factual. I was reflecting on this thing of is this objective sex education. There are objective facts contained in this program. The program looks at puberty. The program looks at sex. It looks at issues around consent later on in the program. So, you know, it's as factual and as evidence-based as any other program, any other RSE program. But it does, and there's no point in saying otherwise. It is underpinned by values like the values I've listed there: care, compassion, inclusion, helping children develop a sense of their own identity, helping children care for themselves and care for others, and helping children respect themselves and respect others. And those are the values that really underpin the program. And I would just invite parents and teachers to get beyond the headline stuff and to actually engage with the program. Teachers on the ground will know what to do with this. They will know how to use it in their own context. And, you know, that's ultimately, it's presented in that invitational way to teachers as well.
Spirit. Well, I don't know about you, but I've seen lots of lovely bumblebees out recently, even on days when the weather seems cold. Now, some look good, but I've also noticed one or two that look like they might be struggling a bit. Well, our next guest is an expert in pollination ecology, and she's going to talk to us about why this is so important and her tips on how we can support bees during the summer season. It's great to have with us Jane Stout, who's professor in botany at the School of Natural Science in Trinity College Dublin. Okay, Jane, maybe in plain English, pollination, what is it and why is it important?
Okay, in plain English, it's the movement of pollen between flowers. So the pollen is the reproductive, is part of the reproductive part of plants. And plants, obviously, unlike animals, can't move around to find a mate. So pollination is this process of the transfer and deposition of pollen. And this can happen without animals, so it can happen through the wind blowing pollen around, and that's what happens in a lot of grasses. But in nearly 90% of all the flowering plant species on the planet actually have interactions with animals. And as animals visit flowers to find food, so the flowers produce nectar, which is a sugar solution, and the pollen itself is very nutritious as well. So animals visit the flowers to collect food. As they move between the flowers, they accidentally transfer this pollen. And that's what the process of pollination is.
And people might have heard a little bit, Jane, just about the impact that particular environmental impacts that are having on bees and their life cycle and the population of bees. What's been going on and why are bees so important to the world working?
Well, I'll start with that last bit, why bees are so important. So bees are really important pollinators. So they do this job of transferring pollen between flowers. Because of their lifestyle. So bees feed their babies, their larvae, on pollen. That provides the protein to allow them to grow. So they're constantly visiting flowers to collect food to feed to their offspring. So that's what makes them really good pollinators as opposed to other animals that are feeding their young on something else. So bees are really important for doing that. And because so many plants rely on this process in order to produce seeds, continue the plant populations into the next generation, it's a really important process in most terrestrial ecosystems. It's also really important to us as humans because a lot of our food crops require this process of pollination by animals, particularly bees, in order to produce the fruits and the seeds that we consume. So about 75% of all crops worldwide are animal pollinated. Now, the problem is that, like a lot of biodiversity, bees and other pollinators are in decline in general. So in Ireland, there's about 100 species of bee, and about a third of those bee species are actually at risk of extinction. So there's been a decline in both the abundance and the diversity of bees and other pollinating animals because of human activity. So things like intensification of agriculture, in things like pollution, urbanisation, and of course climate change. So all of these processes that humanity is increasing.
We're part of it, Jane. So my last question to you then is: we know this is happening. So what can individuals do on a practical level to try and help the bees?
Well, what the bees need is food and places to live, so individuals can actually help that by providing in their gardens food in the form of flowers all the way through the year and some undisturbed areas, some shelter in which they can nest. And I think a lot of people want to do something actively, they want to plant flowers, but often one way just to encourage more flowers in your garden is to just mow your lawn less and let the dandelions, let the daisies, the clover come through in the lawn. So I would recommend to people to have a look on our website, pollinators.ie. It's the All Ireland Pollinator Plan website. And there's loads of tips and resources. And you can actually, in there, you can pledge your garden for pollinators. And there's some advice on how to do that right the way through the season.
Spirit. I think, I don't know about you, but a lot of people would agree that one of the positive things about the last 14 months of this pandemic is that we've had time to reflect on what's important in life. And so how many times have you had a conversation with someone who say, when will things go back to normal? But do you want things to go back to the way they were? Have we got a new normal? Have we got a better normal? That's what we're going to be talking about with our next guest, who's Sean Booth, the pastor of the Open Arms Church in Newbridge. And it's great to have Sean with us. And we might start with that, Sean, but maybe let's just talk about that, this idea of going back to normal. But the old normal had a lot of stress and busyness in it that maybe we don't need or want to go back to.
Good morning, Wendy. Great to be with you today. Yes, totally agree with you. And I think for all of us, we can say that this season has caused us to really reflect and to pause and look at the ways that we're living. Many who were commuting to work, many who were filled with maybe climbing the ladder and going through a path of success and discovering that way is not working. And in fact, many of us are coming to grips with the tension of what was normal and what we're living in today. And many of us want to define that. And really, we as a church, we're going through this series and we're looking at stress and busyness and being overworked and overwhelmed, but also how do we find rest and solitude and peace? And ultimately, the answer is found in Jesus Christ. And as he says in Matthew 11:28, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. And I think today we could describe ourselves, body, mind, and soul, as weary and burdened. And ultimately, once we come to him, we will truly find rest.
And that's the thing, is this idea of, like, from a faith perspective, from a Christian perspective, peace is something that's really important. And Jesus also said, you know, I came so you could have life and live it to the full. But maybe people have been reflecting, Sean, about, wow, I wasn't really living life to the full. There's been so many different kind of commentators and conversations maybe we've had and articles written basically saying, you know, I'm not going to go back to working 50 hours a week and missing out on so much of my children's life or whatever it might be. It can be different things for different people. But still, I fear for me and maybe for many others, if things do go back to a version of normal, we might fall out of that promise we made to ourselves. So how do we keep bringing it back to that, to what really matters and to what's important?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, even for my own life personally, my home is chaotic, as is, I'm sure, many people. We've got three young children. We've got one more on the way, all boys. And, you know, we've got a busy responsibility as a pastor, as leaders, even in our own marriage as well, just trying to, you know, it feels like so often there's so many different roles and you're so many different balls to juggle. And I think ultimately it's keep coming back to those habits that Jesus we'll talk about, and ultimately for us, it's silence, it's solitude with Him. I think our souls are hungry for silence. Our souls are weary because they're filled with noise and distraction, whether that comes from entertainment, social media, or just, you know, keeping up with the standards of our living. And I think it's just setting in a routine, whether that's at the beginning of the morning, lasting at night, coming and pausing and turning off all distractions, and spending time with Jesus. You know, in a secular world, you know, health, wellness understands this. They call mindfulness is a wave that's roaming throughout the world. And really, mindfulness is to empty your mind. But meditation with Jesus is to fill your mind with Him. And I think it's
to fill it with the good stuff. And it's interesting, Sean, that you talk about silence, because it might sound strange, but it's actually something you need to practice at. It's not actually easy to be silent and meditate and try to fill your mind with good stuff, because we're so used to being distracted. And, you know, you're watching TV, you're on your phone, the child is pulling out of your leg. In a way, are we kind of afraid of silence almost?
Oh, yes, of course. You know, I don't know if you've ever tried to do that. You sit down for a few moments and you're itching straight away to answer a notification or to check something on your phone or whatever it is. Even if we're sitting in the car, you know, we're waiting in a queue. It's just that constant adrenaline and the cortisol is running through our veins. And I think it takes time. It takes practice. You're not going to, you know, succeed at it the first go. It often takes a minimum of 30 minutes. But just to sit in silence, for me personally, I take a journal, I write down, I say, Jesus, will you speak to me? If there's any thoughts or emotions that I'm experiencing in that moment, I write them down. And I just surrender to Jesus and just try and find that center and that silence in my heart and in my soul. And it is difficult, but it's like often for many of us going to the gym, when we used to go to the gym, the feeling of it afterwards is, wow, I need to do this more often. This is exactly what I need.
Well, finally, just to ask you, Sean, you know, we have an opportunity, we have a chance at the moment to say, yeah, I've been exploring these big questions, I've been reflecting on what matters. I want to start new good habits or continue good habits. But we gotta be realistic too. Where would your advice be for people listening to start to have that sense of peace and that sense of silence?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the first thing to do is to start where we're at, not where we think we should be. Oftentimes we set a goal that is unrealistic, like, you know, I'm going to every day for an hour, I'm going to turn off everything and I'm going to have silence. That might not be realistic. Maybe it's to start with 10 minutes. Maybe it's to just get up 10, 15 minutes before you start your day or after you're going to bed and everyone else is going to bed, and just to take that silence and to pray a very simple prayer. You know, Our Father, that so many of us are so used to saying it off and rattling it off. Maybe just to center yourself and pray the Our Father and just be able to welcome Jesus into your space and experience His presence. It really is as simple as that. But start small, start now, and allow that to grow, and that habit will grow as you continue to do it.
Great advice, Sean. Thanks so much for joining us today. That's Pastor Sean Booth, is the pastor at Open Arms Church in Newbridge. Spirit. Church leaders have been more vocal in recent weeks about the restrictions on public worship, particularly when you contrast the rules on either side of the border. Recently, I chatted to Archbishop Eamon Martin. He's the Catholic Archbishop of Armagh and Primate of All Ireland. And first, I asked him about how the pandemic had affected his day-to-day life.
Yeah, I think like many people, we've really had to sort of consider how we're living our lives, our lifestyle. The things we had taken for granted about being able to socialise, to be with friends, to be with family, to travel around, to go out for a meal the odd time. You know, these are things that have been taken away for us, and we've had to basically find new ways of relating and to linking with our friends and family. I know from speaking to people on the ground that a lot of them have been struggling to cope, particularly those who have difficulties in their lives, financial worries, pressures in relationship, recovering from addictions, for example. A lot of the people that our priests and pastoral workers on the ground are meeting are actually struggling with a lot of the big issues in their lives, their families, their children, their young people, their education, their plans for the future. And that's not to mention the things that help us to refresh ourselves, like holidays or a day away or a night out. I think that a lot of families, a lot of people in our parishes have been finding the whole restrictions immensely frustrating. And I think they all just want something to be eased. At the same time, I have to commend people who have made incredible sacrifices and, you know, maybe gone without in order to protect health, to safeguard life, and to promote the common good. These are the reasons why we have engaged in this kind of prolonged Lent of self-denial. And I have to commend people who have been so good. They've been doing so, I think, because they realise how vulnerable our elderly, our sick people are, and indeed our health workers, who are the people on the hospital lines trying to cope in the IC units. Thank God the messages are more positive these days. So I think people are ready to return. And that's not even to begin to mention return to public worship.
Recently, yourself and other bishops came together and you made quite a strong statement where you were really trying to appeal to those who are making these decisions. You've had some communication and meetings since that statement was made. What is the update?
Yeah, well, first of all, you're right to say that we felt that things had gone beyond what was simply preserving public health and had become much more prohibitive about public worship. I mean, it's important for me to say, first of all, that since the very beginning of the pandemic and all of the restrictions, the churches, the Catholic Church and the other Christian churches, and indeed other faiths, we have been making massive efforts to promote the public health message, to keep people safe. Often that meant a stay-at-home message. And we have cooperated fully to try to ensure that our church buildings and all activities associated with the parish and the church are as safe as possible. And we know that on the ground, the kind of efforts that have been made in parishes by teams and cleaners and stewards and all sorts of people to make sure the church is a safe place. Whenever this moved, however, beyond Lent and Easter, because we made a real impassioned plea to the Taoiseach to allow some small, safe gatherings to happen over Easter, and that didn't happen. Neither were we given any prospect of return to worship. And then, just last week, a statutory instrument is legislated into Irish law, which makes it a criminal offence for somebody to gather for worship, or a priest to host a mass, or indeed many of the other aspects of worship that we take for granted. We felt we'd had enough then, because even to attach penal provisions to this, when there had been no widespread evidence of abuse by church or faith groups, we felt this was a breach of the trust. And it also showed a lack of maturity or dialogue between the church and state as to what they wanted. Let me contrast the situation in Ireland with what was happening north of the border. North of the border, throughout the pandemic, we've had very regular meetings between church leaders and indeed church officials and the public health authorities and the state, so that we understand where each other are coming from. That meant that after Christmas, the assembly in Northern Ireland was able to say to the churches, I'll tell you what, we'll no longer regulate you. You regulate yourselves. And at that point, the church leaders in Northern Ireland, we agreed together to remain closed from public worship. But equally, coming up to Easter, we collectively decided to reopen with the blessing of the assembly, the executive, and with the blessing of the public health authorities. In the South, no such conversations at any regular level. And therefore, that kind of sense of one didn't know what the other was doing. So the statutory instrument, one of the other reasons why it upset us so much was it just appeared. We didn't know it was coming.
It was kind of a blunt way of putting across this message when there hadn't been a dialogue. And you're in such that unique position, Archbishop Eamon, where you're getting the, as you've highlighted, the experience of both, even in your own diocese. You know, some of your churches are open, others are not, depending on which side of the border they're in.
Yes, and I made these points. I met with Minister Donnelly. Yeah. I made these points very strongly to him. And I also said to him that I felt in some ways that we had been let down in the churches, that this had all happened around us without any consultation or dialogue. Now, thank God, there's good news at this stage. The Taoiseach wrote to me and indeed to all the church and faith leaders to say that they would indeed work very strongly now for the restoration of public worship as soon as public health authorities give the go-ahead for the lifting of restrictions. So we're hoping that as soon as possible from the 4th of May, we will be beginning to reopen for public worship. And I wrote a message to my priests and parishes to say, listen, get together now, start planning. We're opening up again very soon. So that's good news. And I hope that our anxieties were heard and that there is a new realization now that it's better to do business through dialogue and discussion rather than through statutory instruments. And the way I put it was by waving the big stick, because there was no need. We were cooperating fully with the public health message.
That was Archbishop Eamon Martin. He's the Catholic Primate of Ireland. Spirit. Do you have a bank account with KBC or Ulster Bank or maybe both? And have you thought about, well, what should you be doing if you've got savings accounts there? Because these banks, of course, are preparing to exit the banking market in Ireland. On the line to give us his advice, we have financial expert and author of the Money Doctor books and website moneydoctors.ie. John Lowe is with us. John, first of all, let's start with that. These two banks are going to be leaving the Irish market. How quickly is this going to happen? In other words, should people be panicking?
Absolutely not. No, Ulster Bank, as you know, have obviously RBS, who were basically taken over by NatWest as such, have given their intention that they're going to leave probably within the next 6 years. KBC have got a memorandum of understanding, they call it, with Bank of Ireland. So anybody who does nothing, all their kind of assets will go across to Bank of Ireland eventually, whenever that is. Again, I think it's going to be longer than sooner. Essentially, there's 25 billion in deposits between these two banks, Wendy. So essentially, you know, what are those people, what can they do now with it? What I would suggest, number one, is, you know, look at your life at the moment and where it's at. Do you need to pay off expensive, high-interest, short-term debt? Do you need to pay off your mortgage even? I mean, some people are still going around with a very expensive mortgage interest rate. They haven't shopped around and, you know, they could be paying maybe 3.5%, 4%, where you can get a 1.95% 7-year fixed rate. But again, apathy is a great thing, Wendy. Also then your pension contribution, you might want to put some money into that. Again, hugely underfunded. I've spoken so often about pensions in terms of the shortfall and that within maybe 25, 30 years, I think there won't be such a thing as the state pension. I think it'll be abolished. So
we're gonna have to rely on our own pension pots. Yeah, and
I was gonna say the sad part is, Wendy, that 57.6% of the working population have nothing to look forward to other than that state pension.
And John, just on that, you know, the fact that a lot of the suggestions you're giving us are are looking at where can we put the money. But it doesn't seem like you're talking about savings or deposit accounts because the interest rates are so low. And it's unusual. I mean, we have these two banks exiting the market, but there hasn't been kind of a raft of other banks saying, here's some great offers in our savings account. Maybe in the mortgage market, there'll be a little bit of trying to post those mortgages, but our saving deposit accounts kind of almost losing us money because the interest rates are so low.
They're absolutely awful, Wendy. Absolutely awful. I mean, the very best demand rate is 0.01%, and that's before dirt tax. So we take the 33% dirt tax off that. It's 0.0067%. The very best deposit rate in the country, believe it or not, is part of the state savings with the NTMA, the National Treasury Management Agency, and they have a 10-year National Solidarity Bond where they give you 10% into your fist at the end of 10 years. So if you have 1,000 or 100,000, that you'll get 110,000 in 10 years' time. Now, you go to the two pillar banks and say, here's 100 grand, give me 110,000 in 10 years' time, because they have to deduct dirt tax. They'd have to give you a gross rate of 1.43% each year. And that, Wendy, is the best deposit product in Ireland currently. So nothing really to get excited about.
Yeah. So look around elsewhere at other options that you've mentioned. Just finally to ask you, John, what about someone who's listening who just says, I don't want to do anything, I'm just going to leave it there. When the banks exit, what happens to your money?
Well, I mean, first of all, Ulster Bank will, you know, they'll kind of carve up their book, whether it's mortgages, whether it's deposits, and you'll find that maybe, you know, the Permanent TSB will grab, they're looking to grab a lot of those deposits with Ulster Bank. KBC, obviously, is Bank of Ireland. I mean, you can go to the Competition and Consumer Protection, which is a mouthful, ccpc.ie, which is a government body which basically will have under money tools and then under current accounts, give you all of those kind of current accounts available. If you want to transfer over to them, you can see which one suits your particular needs. You've also got even like N26. I couldn't believe it when I looked at that this morning. N26 is on that list, which is a German kind of bank, which they use basically a credit card. It's online, an online bank. But Revolut is not, which I thought was kind of surprising when we have a million people plus who have Revolut cards. But as I say, it's really shopping around. Certainly, you know, the interest rates are not going to attract anybody leaving Ulster Bank or KBC.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.